Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. To those of you in the room and those who are listening through our cybercasting of this event, my name is William Allen. I'm the professor of law and business here at New York University and the director of the NYU Center for Law and Business. We're tremendously gratified and pleased to be hosting today an extraordinary session of the Securities Exchange Commission Historical Society. All of us who study corporate law and securities law understand that the U.S. system is really a leader across the world in the development of the regulation of capital markets. And in no respect is the U.S. system more special and more highly developed than in its enforcement capacity. Today we have an extraordinary group of officials, past and present, from the SEC Enforcement Division to talk about enforcement of the securities and exchange laws and regulations. And leading that discussion is going to be a friend of mine and a friend of this school, Mr. Ted Levine. Ted is the former deputy chief of the Enforcement Division of the SEC, and having done that, he then moved to the world of practice, where he was a partner in Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, moved to the world of securities industry, where he was executive vice president of Payne Weber, and most recently he is a counsel to the New York firm of Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz, a great securities lawyer. And I'll leave it to Ted to introduce the other outstanding members of the panel. Ted?
Thank you, Bill. It is also my pleasure to welcome all of you here to NYU and all of you who are listening in live on www.sechistorical.org to the Enforcement Remedies panel being presented by the Historical Society in partnership with NYU Center for Law and Business. For those who don't know it, the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society is a nonprofit organization separate from and independent of the SEC. The Society preserves and shares SEC and securities history through our virtual museum and archive, which can be located at www.sechistorical.org. Today's program, which is being heard live, will be preserved in the museum so one can listen to the discussion or read the transcript later. Much of the work of the Society is made possible through the time and talents of the many volunteer leaders who help grow the virtual museum and archive. I would like to commend especially Dan Hawk, who is on the SEC staff, who has developed and nurtured today's program. The Society receives no federal funding, and we are grateful to the many individuals and institutions which join in support of the museum and the archive. And also, the Society appreciates the support of many SEC alumni who contribute to our work and those who actually help the Society grow. And that has led us to this program today, which is the Enforcement Remedies Program. What I'd like to do first is introduce the panelists today. Joining me is an incredible group of talented, experienced SEC practitioners, which we're very fortunate to have and very appreciative of their committing the time to do this. On my far right is Ralph Farrar of LaBeouf, Lamb, Green, and McRae. Ralph, who worked with me at the Commission and is a former general counsel of the Commission, has been one of the leading practitioners in the field of security laws and securities enforcement for the last 25, 30 years. He doesn't look that old. Bill McLucas, who is the other distinguished gentleman up here, is a partner of Wilmer Cutler, Hale & Dorr. Bill is a former staff member of the Commission and former director of the Division of Enforcement, also one of the leading security practitioners in the United States. Between Bill and Ralph is Linda Thompson, who is the current director of enforcement at the SEC, and we're very appreciative of Linda being here. And also on the panel is Mary Shapiro, vice chairman of the NESD, a former SEC chairman, and once again a very experienced practitioner in the field of enforcement, as well as sitting as a former commissioner and now a very senior person at the NASD. I should give a caveat that the remarks today are solely those of the speakers and are not representative of the society or the commission, and obviously we're not giving legal or investment advice, but you probably can figure that out by looking at the panel. We'll not be taking questions during the program, but there is a reception which follows, and if someone has a question, we'll be happy to talk to you about it. So let me turn to the program, and one of the things that prompted us to put together this program was the question of the remedies available to the SEC in enforcement context and to the SROs, the NASD, the New York Stock Exchange, and others. The past few years has been dominated by headlines of improper business conduct and conflicts both in the financial service industry and corporate America. And the response from the SEC, the SROs, and criminal authorities have been very aggressive in response to those events. In 2002, Congress passed Sarbanes-Oxley, which bolstered the SEC's enforcement arsenal significantly. And today, the SEC has the broadest range of remedies from which to choose and the greatest flexibility in applying those remedies than in any time in its 71-year history. What we hope to do today is explore some of those remedies, see how the courts and the commission and the SROs have been interpreting them, and see if we can shed a little light on where the programs are going. So I'd like to turn first to Bill McLucas to give a little sense of one of the hallmarks of the commission staff is its civil injunctive powers as an enforcement remedy, and also more recently a cease and desist remedy. Bill, if you could give us a little history of how those developed and some of the issues surrounding that and the use of those remedies.
Thanks, Ted. It's interesting. Ted mentioned that in the 71 years of the SEC's existence, it's had a both a rich history, but one that as we look at the world today, I think many of us might forget that for 51 of those 71 years, the SEC's basic remedy was civil injunctive relief, period. 1964, the SEC, through amendments to the Exchange Act, got some administrative powers to deal with violations of the 34 Act. Those generally, though, were confined to obey the law administrative orders with some marginally more invasive and substantive statutory remedies for regulated entities, broker-dealers and investment advisors and investment companies. But for most of the life of the SEC, the basic remedy that was available to the agency and that formed the core of the entire enforcement program was an obey-the-law injunction. As we look at where we've been, particularly in the last 5 or 6 years, in our marketplace and in the law enforcement climate, and look at Enron and WorldCom and Adelphia and a whole host of other cases, and look at the criminal prosecutions and the size of the penalties that have been levied, I think we tend to forget that for the overwhelming majority of this agency's life, it had no authority to do anything other than ask a court to enter an order that required the offending corporation or individual to basically do what he or she or it should have done in the first place, obey the law. Nevertheless, if you look at the 60s and into the 70s, generally speaking, the SEC was still quite remarkably effective in its enforcement program. Much has changed in the several decades since then, but the concept of the agency's mission being one designed to get prophylactic relief only, and then use the idea of public charges and airing the dirty laundry associated with violations of the law or misconduct, was an extraordinarily effective vehicle in the marketplace for the SEC to police market behavior. The evolution of that very plain vanilla and basic remedy to where we are today has happened quite quickly. In 84, the SEC, for the first time in its history, got the authority to level statutory penalties, only in insider trading cases. As we moved into the 1980s from the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and the foreign payments and the off-the-book slush funds investigations of the 70s, the markets experienced a period of very substantial merger and acquisition change of control activity. Along with that activity came the prospect of individuals making a fair amount of money by trading in advance of change of control situations, in effect, insider trading in takeover situations. Those cases, which involved at the time what today seems like a relatively small amount of money, but extraordinary financial opportunities for individuals in public companies, law firms, investment banks, financial advisors, to capitalize on the information in advance of a takeover, led the Commission to seek and the Congress to pass what was called the Insider Trading Sanctions Act in 1984. The Act essentially said that if you were found to have engaged in insider trading, you were susceptible now not only to paying back the ill-gotten gain with interest, but to a penalty of three times the gain that you'd put in your pocket from the trading or the loss that you'd avoided in the instance of a bad news selling. That remedy, which was extraordinarily effective as the SEC moved through the Dennis Levine, Ivan Boesky, Marty Siegel, and into the Michael Milken, Drexel Burnham kinds of investigations, really captured sort of the attention of the marketplace and was viewed as a centerpiece of this agency's extraordinary powers to go after people who engaged in insider trading. The next step in the evolution of expanding the agency's authority was, in 1988, passage of what was called the Insider Trading Securities Enforcement Act, which very slightly broadened the penalty powers to add vicarious liability. It had a provision called controlling persons provision, which said that anybody who employed or controlled a third party who engaged in insider trading could be held vicariously liable for the bad actor's conduct. And the statute imposed some affirmative obligations on investment banks and broker-dealers. But you saw in the space of 4 or 5 years an expansion of the penalty authority of the Commission, but confined very narrowly to a species of behavior that had captured the attention of the Commission and was viewed as the worst conduct in the marketplace, and that was insider trading. Now, by the time we moved through the 80s and into the 90s, we had experienced a debacle in the savings and loan industry and a series of cases involving, in effect, looting of the industry, substantial number of criminal prosecutions and investigations by the federal banking regulators. And the individual who had been the head of the task force on financial institutions in the Reagan-Bush White House was a guy named Richard Breeden in the first Bush in the Reagan administration. He'd gone off and gone into private practice and was nominated to be the chairman of the SEC when President Bush took over, and came into the position with a view colored largely by his experience at watching the S&L industry and what he viewed to be the relatively weak authority that the banking regulators had, that when you looked at the SEC's arsenal, the power the Commission had was frankly quite weak. And in relatively short order, had put together a recommendation to expand the SEC's enforcement arsenal to include penalty authority across the board. Statute that was passed in October of 1990 was the Remedies Act. And the Remedies Act, very basically, provided for financial penalties for virtually any violation of the federal securities laws. If you look at the statute, there are tiers for the penalties that are keyed to the gravity of the violation, the level of scienter involved by the actor, the level of damage to investors in the marketplace. But it was a remarkable And in retrospect, a piece of legislation that passed without a lot of controversy or objection, but fundamentally changed the landscape for the way the SEC was going to deal with violations of the law, and in some respects involved quite a bit of foresight, because the markets had changed dramatically in the late 80s and certainly in the 90s. We quadrupled the number of individual investors who were participating in the marketplace, and by every market metric, the SEC's regulatory charge expanded exponentially. But now, we had an agency empowered to go out and literally collect its pound of flesh when there were violations of the law. The penalty authority was used, it evolved, I guess is the correct way to describe it, and it evolved quite gradually, and I might say responsibly, during the 90s.
Is that when you were running the division?
Indeed it was.
Okay.
Those were referred to as the golden years, but that's for a different panel.
The record of responsibility continues to this day.
Well, I'll leave that for the defense bar to judge, but what you saw was basically an agency that now had an arsenal that I don't think people really anticipated what has happened in the marketplace in the 15 years since the passage of that act, but it's been quite a stunning development in which we've seen that penalty power used in a way which I don't think anyone could have imagined 15 years ago.
Bill, I'd like to ask you a question. I was at the commission at the same time, and I should know the answer, but I don't. When the Remedies Act came into effect, was the Enforcement Division pushed into the position of litigating a lot more cases than it had before, or were you settling at about the same rate as historically?
There was a marginal uptick in the litigation, but I think that the approach to penalties was aggressive in some respects, but nowhere near sort of the exponential change in the landscape that I think we've seen, for instance, since 1999 and 2000. If you divide the universe into, as I think you fairly can now, pre-Enron and post-Enron, whatever we thought the rules or the standards were when people like Ralph and Ted were at the commission quite a few years ago, the world changed dramatically after Enron, and those penalty powers, even in the minds of people who were accustomed to seeing some pretty serious cases, began to get wielded with numbers and with a ferocity that I don't think anyone had anticipated, certainly at the passage of the Act, and even as some of the scandals unfolded. The degree to which the Commission and the staff determined that seeking financial penalties was going to be the preferred vehicle of punishment, I think has surprised virtually everybody who had been at the commission and who had seen the evolution of its enforcement program over the years.
Can I just interrupt and ask Ralph and Linda, what Bill has identified, really, he used the word punishment. My recollection is historically the agency viewed itself as essentially a remedial administrative body in order to essentially influence conduct, not as an organization to punish. That was really left to the criminal authorities. And when you talk about penalty and punishment, it has essentially the mandate of the agency been changed by Congress to now it is really a punishment as opposed to a remedial activity agency? And if so, what is the impact of that in both in terms of the relief it can get, the standard of proof that is imposed on the agency, and the willingness of people to settle?
Sorry, do you want the yes or the no first?
You go.
I should go. Okay. Well, look, it's not a fundamental change, right, in the attitude of the agency. We're talking about a radical change to the genetic material from which this agency was grown. Clearly, unquestionably, when you look historically at this agency, the notion was that the SEC, when you look at the Section 21 of the Exchange Act, the SEC was intended to be forward-looking, remedial, and prophylactic in its enforcement program. The notion was, I can recall when we were all puppies at the SEC, which for me was a very long time ago. Stan Sporkin, who was our first deputy director of the enforcement division in those days, later to become director, said to us, look, A, you never deal with a crook. What they had in mind was Vesco, who was the crook at the time. But then he said, if any honest person comes in here, even one who recklessly or even knowingly bumps his or her head into a federal security statute, you take the action that you have to take to protect the public going forward, but you allow that person to walk out with his head high when he walks or she walks out the door. Now, if there was to be punishment, if there was to be something that was retrospective and punitive, then the statute provided a remedy for that. That is, the SEC would meet, consider it, refer it over to the Department of Justice. And what the Department of Justice would do is bring a criminal prosecution. Well, that made for a very healthy agency. It made for an agency where the public, that is the registrants and their officers and directors and professional advisors, when they would stumble, would come in, deal with the SEC, clean up their act, shoot straight going forward, and know that they were going to be able to hold their heads up high and practice their trades going forward. Today, what's happened is that some say you would level the playing field. I'd say we've leveled the basement. What's happened is every agency in town is out for the same thing, and that's a scalp. Every agency in town, whether it be the Department of Justice, the State Attorney General, the SEC, God bless them, the self-regulatory organizations, they're not quite there yet, want one thing, and that is a vindication of a public right cast in terms of retrospective, punitive, criminal-like relief. Now, what that means is, A, people like me say, what the hell, you might as well fight. If you're going to be out of business for the rest of your life, you might as well pay. The longer you can stay in business before the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court throws you out, the better off you are. Or, alternatively, it leaves other people to say, why go to the SEC to begin with? Now if I go to the SEC, I'm going to get whacked, and I'm going to get branded as a criminal. A civil penalty and a fine, I can tell you, are two sides of the same coin. So, it's not just been a change. I mean, the genetic material has been forever altered. The biggest mistake Congress ever made, in my judgment, is to give the SEC the ability to enter a civil penalty against a wrongdoer. When that happened, the entire fate and face of the agency changed.
Well, I'm glad you don't have a passion about this. So maybe, Linda, having heard that, and we'll come back to some, once we talk about philosophy for a little while, a little more of the nuance, what's your sense of having been at the commission for a while and inherited this power? How do you deal with this in terms of what we talked about of the remedial aspect of the commission's work and the punitive aspect of a penalty, and how is that factored in? And I'm then going to ask Mary the same question from an SRO point of view.
Well, I think with all due respect, Ralph, I do think all remedies have multiple purposes and always had, and they fall into sort of one of three categories, all of which overlap. There is a punishment element to almost every remedy or almost any law enforcement reaction to illegal conduct. There is also a protective mechanism built into most law enforcement remedies, or some of them. And there's finally the sort of prevention element, some of which is looking forward, some of which is deterrence. And I think it is still the case, has always been the case, certainly for the SEC, fortunately, because of where the law enforcement function was so well established, that we could be looking towards deterrence. And deterrence is measured both in terms of general deterrence and specific deterrence. And it is absolutely the case that to the extent someone or some entity is penalized in a way, is sanctioned in a way that those who watch and see that conclude that they would rather avoid that sanction, rather engage in conduct so as to avoid that kind of remedy, it has served the function of general deterrence. We fortunately deal with a collection of potential respondents and defendants who are deterrable. If your choice, I like to think, if your choice is to steal or starve, regardless of the severity of the sanction and the certainty of the sanction, most people are going to steal, because at that particular moment, starving is a far worse option. For the populations that we see, they have choices other than engaging in illegal activity. And if the sanctions that are that illegal behavior are met with are sufficiently unattractive, then they will change their conduct in such a way that they do not meet those sanctions. So to a certain extent, punishment, as you articulate it, is part of prevention, is part of being forward-looking. I don't think anyone would argue that financial penalties have an element of punishment built into them, but part of that is also a deterrent function.
You know, Mary, what about the your vantage point, both as a commissioner in the past as well as your position with the NASD?
Well, you know, when I got to the SEC in 88, I had had an earlier time in my career been at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which had always had civil penalties, and I was shocked to get to the SEC, the most vaunted, exalted, independent federal agency, and discover they didn't have nearly the powers that this little 500-person CFTC had to create an environment of more honest and fair dealing in the market. So that was a surprise to me. But my perspective from the NASD, I guess I really agree very much with what Linda's just said. I think the events that we have seen in the last 5 to 10 years have been sufficiently harmful to investors and harmful to the marketplace that an injunction to simply go forth and sin no more is not an adequate response. And that's whether you think that the remedies ought to be prophylactic or remedial or, in fact, be punishment. And that in order to really change the behavior of certain components of the industry on a going forward basis, the remedies just had to have more sting than an injunction was having.
Bill, how much of what we've heard of this punishment aspect has been a response to either the press or competition or Congress in terms of the agencies and the SROs reacting to those constituencies rather than really saying a $100 million fine as opposed to a $10 million fine is really going to make a difference to a multi-billion dollar company in terms of punishment of deterrence? How much of it really is a reaction to those elements?
Well, I mean, you've asked one of the key questions, I think. If you take Ralph's point, and much as it pains me to take my defense counsel hat off for a moment, when you think for a moment, Enron, WorldCom, Adelphia, HealthSouth, Kozlowski, Swartz, Ebers, Sullivan, Fastow, if this agency today were in full enforcement regalia with civil injunctive power alone, it would be a failure of public policy. It would fail, I think, investors, taxpayers. That's not a model that is appropriate to what's happened in the marketplace in the last 10 to 15 years. And I happen to think that the agency needs to have the power to do what it's to do some of the things it's trying to do with penalties for both deterrence and to protect investors. That's a different question, however, from the issue of how's the penalty authority being used and what are the barometers of magnitude, of fairness, of deterrence, of penal dimension to what the government is doing. When you look at the competition, you look at the press, when you look at the state regulators that are now in the game, and when you look at what seems to drive some of the decisions of the regulators on the enforcement side, and what seems to be fairly viewed, I think, a competition not only for who gets there first, but who gets the largest chunk, you begin to worry that the factors going into the judgment about how much of a penalty, what should the consequence be, and how should it be imposed, are being influenced by things that are not really what we ought to seek or expect from law enforcement in terms of what the consequence ought to be. I do believe there's a dimension to the competition, there's a reaction to the press that's disproportionately influencing the effort to basically get a measured and an appropriate consequence from some of the conduct, which is inexcusable. You could not run a law enforcement program today without this authority, given what we've seen in the marketplace. I think the government fairly struggles with, is it 10 million or is it 100 million with a multinational that had income of 2.8 billion? I don't know what the right answer is there. Some hopefully consequence of public opprobrium and market damage to reputation. Steel is a measure of the consequence. But I do worry that how one sets the number is sometimes affected by things other than the pure effort to say what should the right number be.
There's one of,
if I could comment, Ted, I'll tell you, this question of public policy on this is an important one. And perhaps there's a reason why they put me at the far right end of this table, huh? I'll tell you.
You're the last one here.
To me, to sit down and to talk about Enron, WorldCom, Adelphia, Tyco, maybe Refco, as being kind of the goalposts against which public policy balls have to be kicked is a huge mistake. What I see around the country from boardroom to boardroom is that there are honest executives. The other 10,000 publicly held companies with the tens of, maybe hundreds of thousands of executives who run them, who now run in fear that if they crack a wing in their business plan, it's going to be called fraud and they're going to be sanctioned for it. The public policy decisions that are made to deal with a handful of high-profile cases that have been stoked out of proportion by the media is, to me, a public policy disaster. And we can tinker with tax policy, fiscal policy, monetary policy. We can do anything we want to talk people up. But until American enterprise, American managers, once again get the guts to take risk and to keep us being a growth instead of a kind of utility-driven economy, we're going to be in trouble. It is a public policy disaster.
Well, let me ask.
We have grossly overcompensated legislatively. I was there when Sarbanes-Oxley was passed. I was among those who was petitioning for this or that provision. And I'll tell you, if you had gone before the Congress and said that executives who do X should be eviscerated and scrimshawed, they would have done it.
Well, Ralph, let me ask Linda and Mary this question. Does every violation of a security law warrant a penalty? Or saying it differently, how do you determine in a given case whether you should have a penalty component of it? Because reading what's happening, with very few exceptions, it looks like there's a penalty involved in every case. So what are the factors internally that you look at the SEC and the NASD in determining whether a penalty should be put in? And secondly, when you answer that also, do you really care about the other relief involved, or is it really the penalty that's the most important thing?
The penalties are not imposed in every case. And I think what's interesting is I recently went back and took a look at financial fraud cases, for example, and to see the number of cases where there were financial penalties and the number of cases where there were financial fraud or financial reporting cases at all, to see whether or not there were penalties, for example, imposed against the entity, which is perhaps the most controversial issue out there. And we have had hundreds of cases since, you know, going back 2 or 3 years, involving financial fraud and financial reporting, and I believe the number of cases with penalties levied against issuers, which is frankly what everybody on this panel is talking about, although they're not saying it, is measured in about 20. It's really a rarity. It does suggest that they work. Well, that may say something about...
You got to put your mic on.
There's got to be more than 20. I mean, I can't be the only loser out here.
apparently, it's these two guys.
Well, that just maybe. Excuse me. I'll tell you, I would be much more calm and pleasant in these programs if maybe the next five times I come in, you give me no penalty.
Actually, let me just stop and focus this. Mary, what about you? Because let me just stop at the issuer, because actually both the regulated as well as the corporate America has the issuer question. I think up to the last 5 or 6 years ago, maybe more, there were never a civil penalty imposed against an issuer. Among other things, I think the theory is that the issuer has shareholders who are innocent shareholders, and therefore by imposing a penalty, you'll be essentially harming innocent shareholders. That has obviously changed, and I'm taking out the WorldComs of the world for a minute. Is there any difference or in thinking when you look to whether you're going to impose a civil penalty as a condition of settlement or litigation on the public company which has shareholders, or is that not part of the mix?
For us, with just jurisdiction over broker-dealers, the question would be limited to broker-dealers that are public companies, and I don't think it's something that we have given a lot of thought to, but we do give a lot of thought to the size of the broker-dealer when we're talking about the penalty. There are 5,200 broker-dealers in the United States. The vast majority of them are small operations. Well over 4,000 of them have just a handful of employees. And a small firm like that violates the securities laws, and a large firm that violates the same laws are not going to have a penalty, even if the conduct was the same. That's equivalent, because we'll put the small firm out of business, and if that's what we want to do, that's what we should do. But we shouldn't assess a penalty against them that is going to drive them into net capital violations and take them right out of business. So we don't have so much the public, non-public line that we draw, but we absolutely look at the size of the broker-dealer when we're evaluating the type of penalty. We also look at the extent of investor harm, and the greater the investor harm, the more likely there will be a significant monetary penalty. We look at whether the firms are recidivist, and you all read the newspaper, and you know as well as I do how many firms have shown up month after month after month in the monthly disciplinary actions from the NASD or the SEC or the New York Stock Exchange. And so recidivism is a factor, and then just the underlying egregiousness of the violation. But to go back to the question you asked Linda at first, because I want to respond, and I respond at the risk of having the SEC's Office of Compliance Inspections and Examinations all over me. Every violation of the securities laws does not lead to either a case or a penalty. In the course of our investigating and examining our brokerage firms, and we examine about 2,500 of them a year, there are hundreds of areas where they are not in full compliance with the law, and that leads to a letter of caution or compliance conference with the firm where they're asked to fix the problem, and we'll be back to check on whether they did, but where there's not a referral to the enforcement department.
Linda, I'm sorry.
I was going to ask if we could complete the legislative history, because we left out a chapter on penalties, which is important to my mind as to where we are, and that's 2002, with the enactment of Sarbanes-Oxley, because in Sarbanes-Oxley, among other things, there was a provision there was the fair funds provision, which allows penalties that are collected to go back to shareholders as opposed to go to the United States Treasury. Until the enactment of Sarbanes-Oxley, penalties and securities law enforcement actions went to the United States Treasury. And that keys into something that Ted referred to, which is the notion when you're talking about penalties and public issuers, the need to consider, as Congress urged the SEC to do, the impact on shareholders. We need to consider whether the shareholders who are the owners of the company at the time were victimized by the conduct that's at issue, whether they benefited from the conduct at issue, and whether or not there's been a sufficient passage of time to affect who the shareholders are at the time the penalty is imposed. The devil is, of course, in the details, because the issue is, what is a benefit to a shareholder, and when you measure it. So, for example, is an inflated stock value a benefit to a shareholder, realized or unrealized? And it can be. Is the fact that a company can use inflated stock as currency, a benefit to the company and to the shareholder. Is the fact that a company looks to outperform others in its market segment by virtue of the financial fraud it's engaged in and therefore sort of beats its competition by virtue of an ongoing yet undisclosed fraud a benefit to the shareholders? And those are the kinds of things that can and should be considered in the context of penalties. In Foreign Corrupt Practices Act cases, for example, I think the issue of penalties has never really been disputed terribly much because the bribe was almost always for the benefit, if you will, of the company, even though when disclosed, it turns out to be hardly a benefit at all because of the conduct that because of what is then imposed on the company. I don't think that any penalty that has been levied against a corporation has ever led to certainly in the securities context, sort of the demise of the entity or serious damage to its bond rating or ability to borrow or whatnot. So that sort of long-term, large issue of what you're doing to an entity, I don't think has ever come to fruition.
Well, let me just pick up on that, because one other change, if we're looking at history, Linda just identified, and then I'd like to get the reaction of the panel to it. Historically, the SEC used its equitable powers to obtain disgorgement. Bill defined it as disgorgement of ill-gotten gain, which was an injunction. You're in a court of equity, and one of the powers which was then implied and now after Sarbanes-Oxley is expressed in the statute is the ability to get disgorgement. What Linda just identified with the fair funds provision is essentially the ability to merge civil penalties and disgorgement in order to give back funds to the injured. It used to be the SEC took the position strongly. It was not involved in restitution. It was not a collection agency. It left it to the private bar and others in order to recover. What has happened post-2002 is now the SEC has become a collection agency, I think, or at least a comment, and is involved in that very act of essentially determining who should get money and how it should be given out, which is a different role than it played historically. And I'm wondering, Ralph and all of you, if you could react to that and how that impacts this whole question of civil penalty.
Perhaps begin with just the propriety of it all. To me, there is a dramatic difference between the civil penalty and the disgorgement remedy. Disgorgement really, I guess, means giving back the gold watch, that is, coughing up your ill-gotten gain. And like the old Diamond versus Oreamuno cases or the Brophy case where the corporation could recapture insider trading profits to be held for the person who was injured before there was a direct action under the Exchange Act to do so, those funds, I think, can be, indeed, perhaps should be held by the public agency for distribution to those who got hurt. Conceptually, to me, even though the dollars may be fungible, conceptually to me, the concept of using the civil penalty to compensate investors sets on a different footing. Recall, when the civil penalty provision was first enacted, there was in the legislative history, the Senate report, as I recall it, language that said, we expect that this civil penalty will never be used except in those circumstances where the current shareholders gained an improper benefit from the misconduct. So it seems as though Congress had in mind that this was going to be used sparingly. Now, I, for one, am not comfortable with the notion that you justify the imposition of these sometimes obscene civil penalties, given the nature of the conduct that took place, merely by saying that what we're going to do is throw it into a disgorgement-like fund. Footnote to that, you can't do this through disgorgement. Indeed, this fair funds provision, as I recall it, does not work for disgorgement. It only works for civil penalties. So there's a bias in the fair funds thing towards civil penalties as opposed to disgorgement. A little footnote back to the text. Now that you're there, now that you're using this as a justification for civil penalties, should it go back to the shareholders? To be sure, it should go back to the shareholders rather than go to the United States Treasury. But be careful, because by with all due respect, I think I'll throw that one back at you, by administrative staff fiat, perhaps clothed with some commission authority, when you do the civil penalty and you return it to the shareholder class who claims they were damaged, the commission says you can't take credit for that. That is, the issuer can't use that as an offset to its liability to the class. And you scratch your head and say, what's smart about that? Worse yet, you can't take it as a tax deduction, because normally if you pay damages in a class action, that's a tax deduction for the issuer. So you put it all together and you say, well, of course you get some credit for having it included as part of the fund that goes to shareholders, but what gets you there, that is, using it as a justification for doing these enormous civil penalties to begin with and not having it go through the disgorgement function, which makes good, equitable sense, worries me.
Bill and Mary and Linda, when you negotiate, Bill, with the SROs of the SEC, and Linda and Mary, when you decide based on Bill's advocacy or lack of it, how you come out, how do you determine this mix? Because money's fungible. I mean, there's a dollar amount someone's paying, an issuer's paying, $100 million. It can be $100 million disgorgement. It can be $20 million in penalty, $80 million disgorgement. As Linda said, there is a fair funds which merges it together. How do you arrive at what portion is the penalty and what portion is the disgorgement in that equation?
Yeah. How do you do that?
For NASD, I'll jump in first. We've traditionally said that arbitration was really the means by which individual investors needed to recoup their particular losses as a result of violations of the securities laws or NASD rules. And really in the last several years, coincident, I guess, to some extent with the creation of the Fair Fund, we have moved much more aggressively towards restitution as being sort of the first thing we want to look to before a civil penalty. And it's specifically contemplated in our sanctioning guidelines for our enforcement staff is that whenever we can identify a person or a firm that suffered a quantifiable loss as a result of wrongdoing of the respondent, then restitution is appropriate to order by our hearing panels. And from our perspective, that ought to be the first place money goes. In restitution to investors, and then secondarily to a civil penalty.
But in settlement, Mary, when you give the terms of settlement to Bill and Ralph and their clients, there's always a penalty component of it. It's not simply the restitution component. Because most of the cases you seek a penalty, just like the SEC now. And so the question I'm really focusing on is, there's a mix here. How do you get to that mix? Is in terms of institutionally, how do you figure that out? Which way you go in this? And obviously, the same question to Linda.
Well, for Bill's clients, there's always a penalty, but lots of other lawyers are successful in arguing just for restitution. You know, it's not precise. It's obviously we need to quantify the harm that was caused by the respondent, where we can identify the amount of restitution. That's easy, and we can make that the first port of call in the settlement, and then negotiate aggressively as on both sides as to the amount of the civil penalty that ought to attach on top of that. We have had cases where we have only ordered restitution because the civil penalty on top of that would have been an excessive sanction from our perspective.
Linda?
You need to move from the very specific case to the more general, more difficult cases. Disgorgement, at its simplest level, is sometimes very easy to calculate. Perhaps the best example is an insider trading case where you calculate the gains obtained or the losses avoided. And even that can get complicated when you've got tippies, when it's a loss avoided case, when you have to do market studies. But at a certain level, you figure out what has been obtained from the illegal conduct. Fees, for example, that result from illegal behavior are an easy way to measure disgorgement. even move into salary, for example. Certainly it is easy to say a bonus that is calculated based on share price or performance, and that performance or share price is a result of illegal behavior by the individual, is an easy disgorgement concept. When you move into other, disgorgement being an equitable relief, you're going to look at all the facts and circumstances. So issues like what inflated currency may be used for, what the result is, it may be, it is somewhat harder to articulate, or actually sometimes it's quite easy to articulate, but harder to measure. And it is in those circumstances where you may also start thinking about penalty in that context. A penalty built into the statute, baked into the statute, is the notion that penalty amounts may be calculated based on gain made or loss avoided. That's right in the statute within the tiers. I mean, we talked about the penalty tiers, but an alternative in injunctive actions is the gain that attends to the conduct. But calculating an appropriate range for penalties is difficult. That does not mean that it's random or sort of willful or throwing darts at a board. It requires a very serious analysis of the facts, a very serious analysis of the relative conduct. It requires looking at, for example, the similarly situated entities or individuals. I mean, the goal for us is to treat the similarly situated similarly. And having said that once without tripping, the key is to figure out what's similar and what's different.
Well, can I just stop you? And because this is a critical point, which I want to actually get, since everyone's mic's on, all your views. Since 90% of your cases are settled or more, at least they were, I assume still the case, and since the reasons for paying and settling have no relationship in a lot of those cases to what should be done if it was litigated, because there are reasons people pay and settle that have nothing to do with the merits of the matter, how do you use, and also the Commission's articulated view is that settled cases are not precedent. You shouldn't look to them for precedent. I think they've articulated that in their own opinions. How do you look to settled cases as the barometer for arriving at what should be the penalty or disgorgement in matters which are not settled, or even in other settled cases since they're sui generis?
The analysis that went into the settled case is an analysis that we can surely look to and replicate. And it is absolutely true that prior cases do not bind anyone with respect to the current situation. And if you promise never to raise precedent or historical cases or penalties, say, from 1990 when you come in to negotiate, I'll sort of take it off the table. But it seems to me going to
no one has a memory in the Commission going that back that far.
I'd say the only people up here who remember back that far are the three old guys.
Let me ask you, put it up front, though. I mean, if you bring a case against an issuer, a registrant, or an individual, and the individual listens to you and respectfully says, I disagree, and I'm not going to settle on these terms. I'd like to have a court hear my case. Isn't it true that the penalty amount goes up? That if you litigate the case, the mere fact that you put up a good faith defense is an accelerator on the penalty number?
You mean from a negotiating perspective? No. Perspective?
I come into you, you say, if you want to settle, this is a deal. And the deal is a $1 million penalty. If I go to court, and the only variable is that I put up a good faith, honest defense, not jerking around, holding up documents, have to be punched, put a good faith, honest defense, and I lose, the penalty is almost in $10 million. Does that happen?
No, it's not the tough question. It's actually a very straightforward question that comes up in law enforcement all the time. And another way to spin, if you will, what you just said is the notion that we do want to reward those who are willing to sort of step up to the plate and resolve matters and, you know, sort of figure out where they are and deal with it. And the what underlies your question is the notion that the best deal for a cooperative good citizen, et cetera, is the only deal and the only resolution that's appropriate, regardless of whether or not someone has engaged in obstructionist conduct, whether or not they are recalcitrant about getting to the facts, whether or not they self-report. We do have a range, and we ought to have a range of appropriate remedies for conduct that includes how people respond to the conduct, particularly in a corporate setting. So the notion that there ought to be at some level a premium for, or not so much a premium, because that's actually
that's the problem. But it's not a premium. But you shouldn't pay a penalty for wanting to defend yourself.
Ralph, you should get. But
let me defend Linda. I agree with Linda. What I just heard Linda say is that essentially it's not that they would, if you in all those cases they would seek what if you're litigating, but in order to encourage settlement, they won't compromise what they otherwise seek.
Absolutely. It's a very important semantic difference. It is not so much a premium as a benefit for coming in early and resolving things.
You know, one would say a $150 million penalty is not overviewed as a benefit when you pay that. But having said that, I think philosophically I agree with
you. The problem here is really the point from which you start, and the notion that the staff has is they're giving you a steep discount. And if you're in Ralph's shoes, the notion is this is insane. If you're going to cut one of my arms off, I mean, where's the deal here? And their answer is, well, we're not killing you.
Stop exaggerating. Nobody's arm has been cut off.
No arm's been cut off yet. It's early. Let me raise a point that Ralph's alluded to, which I think is not necessarily on the subject of injunctions, but is critical to how you lawyer and practice in this environment today. Ralph said if you put up a defense, a good faith defense, and good faith is always in the eye of the beholder, I will tell you now the view from within the staff, as we see it on this side of the table, of defending oneself and mounting arguments and doing what lawyers are paid to do, which is be zealous advocates, has changed dramatically in the last 5 or 6 or 7 years. And there is a risk in this climate that the notion of defending your client gets turned around on your client to the client not getting it, the client not being a good corporate citizen, the client not, in effect, knuckling under. Some of the Wall Street Journal editorials about the Attorney General here in New York have raised that particular specter and that criticism. That is a risk to all law enforcement programs, and one that the SEC is neither immune from nor should be insensitive to, but there is a climate now where disagreeing with the government and disagreeing aggressively, Ted said a few minutes ago, people settle cases for a lot of reasons. It doesn't mean, A, they believe they violated the law or they did anything wrong. Generally, people are guilty of some things. They may be stupidity. They may be a combination of stupidity and bad timing. They may be a combination of stupidity, bad timing, and bad press. It doesn't all translate sometimes into what the government believes ought to go within the four corners of a complaint. And right now, there is a risk in this system that advocacy, particularly zealous advocacy with the kind of flair that Ralph brings to the table, for instance, can get turned back on your client to be, in effect, a penalizing component of the way the government will approach your client. Now, it's something I think that the defense bar is not imagining here, and it is a real issue that worries a lot of us out here about how you defend somebody. I want to turn to one other point, and then I'll keep quiet. We've been talking about this in the context of Sarbanes-Oxley. Ralph's correct. Had they constructed gallows across the quad from the SEC during the Sarbanes-Oxley debate and built that into the legislation, it would have sailed through.
There was no real consideration given to this bill at all in the merits.
And one of the phenomena that now we hear from the staff, from individual commissioners, and from the commission itself is individuals. There's got to be individual culpability in these cases. And I'm not talking about Andy Fastow and Enron. I'm talking about every case where there's an accounting issue, a disclosure issue, an FD problem of some nature, You've got to find individuals, because public companies don't. Entities only act through individuals. Therefore, individuals have to be responsible for violating the law. That is, frankly, neither any maxim or principle that holds forth in any organization, nor should it in a law enforcement organization. There are many cases where people do dumb things as a collective. You may have a collective of dumb people. But to say that we're going to go down the hall and we're going to find that assistant controller and we're going to bring him to justice, or we're going to bring the two people who didn't see the get the accounting issue, and much of that pervades the process when you're dealing with the enforcement staff right now in a lot of cases where you're talking about a corporate enterprise. There is a search for individual accountability, and in my opinion, an institutional failure by the agency to accept the proposition, just as happens in the government, and certainly within the SEC in some instances, that failures do not result in individuals always being personally accountable. There was a budget problem with the SEC in the last year.
And the
issue is that the defense bar worries about is there an appetite for accountability and sanctions that doesn't give due account to the fact that people may not be perfect, but they ought not to be personally and individually named in all these cases. And that's something that worries a lot of us.
Listen carefully to what you have just heard by the two gentlemen on either side of me. If you put that in combination, you have just heard is an argument that individuals should not be tagged because they're poor, you know, it would be terrible.
That's absolutely not what I said.
And then we're hearing
that
we ought not to tag entities because it's going to cost them money. It's terrible for the shareholders. So at the end of the day, people and institutions that make an enormous amount of money off of individual investors run by people who have benefits that most people would give several limbs for, talking about cutting off arms, should pass harmless for their illegal behavior. And that is unacceptable.
You almost have it exactly right with a couple of footnotes. So you almost got it exactly right. One, if there's ill-gotten gain, disgorge it. If there has damage that can be cured by restitution, order it. If there is a forward-looking restraint that should be placed on the entity to make sure it doesn't violate the law again, do it. And if there's criminal conduct, refer it for prosecution. Other than that, you had it exactly right.
No, that's entirely not.
Let me rein this in for a minute. Bill gave a great segue, however. We're right on point. I'll turn to Ralph for a second on this question. The Office and Directive Bar.
Oh, yeah.
So one of the elements that follows from what Bill just said about individuals is the Commission's use of its power to bar individuals from being officers or directors of public companies. Under what circumstance should that be done, and how is it being used by the agency?
I mean, don't they regret they gave this one to me? Right? So far, we've only been talking about money. Right? Now we're talking about hides, right? You recall that there was an old movie back in the early 1970s where Charlton Heston was being hunted down by a group of simians, gorillas and chimpanzees and orangutans. I think it was called The Planet of the Apes, and they kind of piled these bodies up, you know. Well, when we're talking about officer and director bars, think that scene, right? If I can mix my metaphors, the SEC's ambition to procure officer and director bars against officials of public companies is a little bit like Ahab's relationship to the great white whale. And it's been going on, at least in theory, at least that long. You go back to the beginning of all this, it's fascinating. You go back, the Commission, at least since the 1960s, had the ability to bar, suspend, or censure a market professional, which is usually a broker, dealer, investment advisor, or the like. Indeed, they could provide sanctions similar to professional organizations, SROs, not that they ever did. So from there, the SEC sought to impose those same types of sanctions, bar, suspension, or pace limitations on people who were not market professionals. And the SEC used all kinds of innovative ways to do this. I can recall that Ted and I, this is a historical thing, so we can talk history, right, like memories. I can recall, I was a puppy at the SEC. There was a time when SEC, yeah, right. There was a time when when Levine and I think were the only two branch chiefs in the Division of Enforcement, there was that day, right? So I come up, I'm the brand new branch chief of the commission, and Ted's got this raging case called executive security. It's going on forever and ever and ever. There's a small piece of it says, Ralph, try this case. In this case, Levine has got Section 15 of the Exchange Act, which is an administrative remedy against brokers and dealers, which says, under one of its provisions, 15b6, as I recall it, that you can bring an administrative proceeding against, quote, any person, but in the section relating to broker-dealers, to censure or to bar them from practice as a broker-dealer. Levine brings this case against the general counsel of the Florida Securities Commission and their chief investigator, and then gives me the case to try. Well, to make a very long story very short, I end up in the hearing. Who shows up on the other side of the bench? This is my first trial. Is Louis Loss. Now, for those of you who are too young to know, there wasn't a field called securities regulation until he invented it, right? He is the opposing counsel for this lawyer and this investigator. So we litigate the case for a little while. We go on, and in the middle of the case, a break is called. Loss has to go out of town. It so happens the 75 Act amendments to the security statutes were going through Congress and were at the conference. Loss goes in, tells conference what's going on in this little proceeding down in Miami, Florida, at the hotel in Miami, Florida, gets the conferees to change the statute to make sure that the SEC can no longer go after any person administratively to censure or to bar them from being a broker-dealer, comes back down with the new statute, signed by the president, puts it on the table, case dismissed. I lost my first case that way. And that was the way the SEC tried to go after human beings who are not brokers or dealers. The statute's amended to say you can only go after brokers and dealers or people who are associated or seeking to become associated with them. That's the way it's
done. Can we talk about where we are now?
Okay, so now, the SEC goes on. The next crack they take at this is like going after lawyers. They have 102E. In the good old days, that late but great, only the goodies gone from the hearts but never from our charts. That is Rule 2E. The SEC would go after and bar the community of lawyers and then accountants. So now we've got brokers, dealers, market professionals, lawyers, and accountants. All that's left are officers and directors of public companies. 1988, the Congress is asked to provide the commission the authority to do it. They turn it down. 1990, Securities Enforcement Remedies and Penny Stock Reform Act of 1990, the court allows it and says that the SEC can go to court and seek to bar an officer or director from ever serving or for serving for a period of years in that capacity in any publicly held company, so long as they show that the officer or director was substantially unfit to do so. Not a bad standard if you're going to allow the SEC to go to court to do this, but, of course, the SEC pushes it to the limit, and the courts don't like it pushing it to the limit. They start defining substantial unfitness in a way that is not to the SEC's liking. Sarbanes-Oxley comes along. Government can get anything it wants in Sarbanes-Oxley. They strike the word substantial from the phrase substantial unfitness. And so now the way the world turns, the SEC can bar a director or officer from serving as such in any public company for life if the SEC persuades a court that they are unfit to do so. Now, what the hell does that mean, unfit to do so? We don't know. The cases are evolving. Does it mean that you have to have engaged in something that is a crime, something that is a violation rife with scienter? Does it mean that you have to have a history of violation? Does it mean that there has to be a reasonable prospect for a future violation? These are all things that are evolving in the courts. I can tell you, though, that in 2003, I stopped counting at 40 of these bars, and I can tell you the remedy de jure at the SEC, if you bump into a federal security statute and you're a CEO, CFO of a public company, particularly if you have to restate and charge with 10b-5, you're looking at a bar.
Okay, well, 40. Why don't I let Linda respond to that? Maybe just not on the history part, just on the current.
You don't like the Planet of the Apes metaphor. I'm sorry. Okay.
It's the return of the Planet of the Apes that I'm worried about.
I am almost left speechless because I'm left with wondering whether what we're seeing here whether the very simple proposition that an officer and director who engages in fraud, and this, you can only get an officer and director bar in situations where there's been an allegation of 10B violation, whether or not that it is silly to suggest that such a person ought not be put in that same position again. And indeed, I circle back to where Ted started, which is if we're forward-looking, if the remedies that people deem to be the most pristine, the most important, which are forward-looking kinds of things, there is nothing more forward-looking than taking a person who has engaged in serious misconduct and putting them in a situation where they can't do it again.
Excuse me. Let me ask you a question. I'm 27 years old. I'm the assistant something or other officer in a public company, and I make a mistake. I trade on inside information. I trade 100 shares. I make $1,500, and it's wrong. And I'm nailed. Why should I, at 27 years old, for having engaged in that true, admitted violation of the insider trading statutes, be barred forever for making a living in any public company in America? Why should that
how
be?
Many,
where is
how
the
many, Ralph? How many? How many permanent bars for insider trading by a 27-year-old?
Let me just jump in here. Let's assume there's only one Ralph's client for this purpose. But let me just stop, because what we're hearing identified, and Bill, I'd also like your view, is the critical question is it enough, and as a matter of policy or law, that someone violated 10B, and that should be the basis for seeking an officer and director bar, or should there be more to it? In other words, should there, and this actually relates not only to, you should know, it's not only going to court now, the commission has the power administratively to do it in the cease and desist proceedings, though they can do it administratively. But the real critical question is, how do you administer the power?
Well, that's the key question. The question is not, should it? Yeah, the Congress has spoken. We are where we are. The issue is not, are you going to say, you can't name public companies, you can't name individuals. The issue is, how is the power being wielded? The issue is, does the government recognize that in the context of settlement, it is doing things to people because people cannot fight? That's the question. That's the issue. It's a question of how the authority is being used and how aggressive the agency is being and what the balance of fairness is in the process. That's the $64,000 question. And the point that's being raised is not one to suggest that you ought not to enforce the law. The point is being, how careful is the government being in recognizing the issues of fairness and the issues of weight, evidence, and balance that ought to be brought to bear in the administering of those powers. And the reason for that is, regardless of what you hear from the government, most people in these companies cannot fight. They can't get indemnified, and if they can, it doesn't matter because they are ruined when the charges are brought.
Linda, how much of a client problem do you have with your client, the commission, in terms of their view of this power as opposed to your own view in the following way, at least episodically, and the sense in terms of cases that we've seen, there's been a lot of focus at the commission, and you can see it through speeches, of holding individuals accountable. And how much pressure do you get from your clients, the five commissioners, in terms of imposing this in a case where an individual is involved in the public company?
I think it's fair to say that there is whatever other issue there may be out there among the five commissioners, there is unanimity that individuals should be held accountable for the conduct they engage in. And there is skepticism on the part of commissioners when terrible things happen that individuals who were involved should not be held to pretty high standards. So I think it's fair to say that the commission will look to individuals, will look closely at their conduct, and is serious about trying to get people who have been intimately involved in terrible conduct out of the business. We don't want to see them again. And I think that there may be all kinds of other issues out there, but it's pretty clear that the commission thinks individuals are and should be held accountable.
We have heard, Linda, that and look, when you express it that way, it's very difficult to disagree with
but
you.
But you're about to.
No. With what you've just said, one can't disagree. But I must say, we hear anecdotally, and of course, what you hear anecdotally may be apocryphal and not truly based, but we hear anecdotally that the sense at the commission is that, you know, planes don't fall out of the sky without pilot error, and if there's a registrant violation, particularly in a restatement case, then somebody's got to go down for the count. And that there is this kind of symbiotic relationship between the O&D bar and the action against the registrant. Now, if that's something different than what you just said.
I think that is probably overstates where things are. I think it is fair to say that the more egregious, using my least favorite word, the violation, the more likely it is that everyone is going to be looking for the individuals who were responsible for example, scienter-based fraud, because at a certain level, everyone is of the view that somebody had to be thinking something. Once you move into areas that are more systems issues, regular, you know, sort of lesser kind of conduct, I think they're both certainly on the staff side and to a certain extent on the commission side, some recognition that certain kinds of conduct can occur that will result in violations of the securities laws, which end up harming a lot of people or causing a great deal of damage, and it may be difficult to find a particular person to identify as responsible for that. Moreover, in response to something that Bill just said, nobody is looking at the guy in the mailroom. What the kinds of individuals that we are interested in keeping, holding accountable are the senior people who are responsible for setting the tone, for setting the culture, for establishing the policies, and for overseeing the enterprise as a whole.
I'm not sure those two guys at Quest were much beyond that, but let me ask you a question. Do you think that the SEC would consider, as it did quite constructively, I think, in Seaboard and Thompson did in the Thompson Memorandum, would you consider giving some content to the concept of unfitness by coming out with a release and saying, as Professor Barnard tried to do before the Shaw case was done, would you consider saying, these are the factors we take into account in determining whether a D or an O who was bumped into an anti-fraud provision should be a candidate for a full bar, a suspension for a period of time, or other limitations on their business?
I don't know that it's necessary, and one of the reasons that I don't know, and I don't know whether we would or we wouldn't, I don't know whether it's necessary, in part because of something you mentioned. You counted up the number of officer and director bars and put the number at 40.
As of
2003, the number of cases we brought that included the kind of conduct for which you could get an officer and director bar was considerably higher than 40. So it does suggest that just by the sheer numbers, that thought and attention is being paid to the process of identifying the officers and directors whose conduct warrants keeping them out of the business for some period of time.
Can I just shift the topic for a moment to one of the other remedies available both to the SEC and to the NESD and SROs is placing limitations on the activities, functions, or operations of broker-dealers and maybe companies. That language came in 1975 also and was designed to give flexibility to the agencies so you didn't have to either suspend or bar someone in the regulated context. The question I have is, as a remedy now, how is either from first Mary from you from the NESD and then Linda from the SEC, how is this power being used? Is it being used as a give you flexibility or is being used in addition to the other things we've already discussed?
We view it as a very tailored response to a set of problems in a firm. We use it quite sparingly. It is specifically contemplated under our sanctioning guidelines. And we use it in very egregious cases generally, or again in cases where there's been recidivism. And the idea is that if a firm has had repeated problems in a particular line of business or with respect to a particular activity, the issuance of research reports, or in the case of a line of business, the sale of a particular type of product or mutual fund, that we will limit their ability to engage in that activity for a period of time. And we've used it about a half a dozen times in the last year, I think pretty successfully. We had several firms that had failed as often as 70% of the time to update their brokers' disclosure records in the central registration depository, an important system for individual investors to see whether their broker has a problem. We've prohibited a couple of those firms from registering any new brokers for a period of time. It doesn't seem like the worst sanction in the world, but if you're a broker-dealer, imagine having to tell a new hire that actually they have to cool it for another week because they've been prohibited by their regulator from registering any new brokers. It has a very direct effect, very narrow in some ways, but a direct effect that responds directly to the kind of conduct. We had another case where a firm had engaged in really serious market timing problems with hedge funds, allowing them effectively to evade all of the mutual funds' prohibitions on market timing by opening serial accounts for the hedge funds. We prohibited that broker-dealer from opening any new mutual fund accounts for a 30-day period. A pretty serious sanction, again, when you think about the fact that they have to tell a new investor that they can't open an account for them. So we found it to be very effective, very powerful remedy, but one to be used sparingly because it is...
Mary, you were a commissioner in the early 90s in a case when I was instructed to leave a particular defendant naked, homeless, and without wheels.
Those were not my words, however.
But you sat quietly by.
Which part did you object to?
The naked part really troubled me. But actually, it was the O'Hagan case, and the terminology by the then chairman got some widespread circulation after the fact. But.
Yeah. Well, let me sort of turn this. There's an interesting decision by the chief administrative law judge of the SEC involving Raymond James, a regulated entity. Brenda Murray. In case which the facts are pretty horrendous, there was theft essentially of multiple $1 million, and the issue was failure to supervise the people who they fired. The SEC enforcement staff sought, in that case, to place a limitation on the business of Raymond James, and among other sanctions that the administrative law judge did not agree with was that, and she declined to order that. And one of the things that struck me in that case is really the question of how you police when you seek this kind of relief in cases and what kind of standards do you seek? Because that was a troubling case in a sense of a lot of the relief you sought was rejected, and it's hard to figure out
why. However, a case that A, went to trial, and B, where, if I'm not mistaken, there were some relatively significant financial penalties imposed in that matter. And I also think, although I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure, that is the same administrative law judge who, in another litigated matter, imposed a limitation on business for another entity. So I think... it is fair to say that all judges, all fact finders, all adjudicators struggle with the issue of appropriate sanctions and an appropriate package of sanctions. And when you're litigating, I think you may very well seek a pretty full range to give the adjudicator the full range of options. I don't think when Raymond James looks at the sanctions that were imposed on it that they have much to cheer about. And I do know that, we also are trying to seek limitations on business activity sparingly. I do think when they are imposed, they are effective, and I'm reasonably confident, that the six-month timeout new business was one that was litigated and imposed by a judge as opposed to, as people have suggested, everybody's just fallen over and, signing up for whatever we request.
Placing limitations just so that you know that I can be consistent. Placing limitations on the activities of an entity, I think, is an appropriate and judicious use of enforcement resources, because what you're doing is applying a prophylaxis. You're saying to an entity that until you can get your act together, your business has to be limited in the following respect.
So why shouldn't we impose limitations on individuals?
You want to bar them.
Well, let me one product of all this, which I sort of want to get a reaction to, is I have noticed, and actually I pointed out when we were talking earlier, two courts of appeals, the Seventh Circuit and Eleventh Circuit, in litigated cases have reacted to this sense of enhanced power and remedy. I think, or I should ask a question, but may also make a statement and ask a question, is causing the courts to view this burden of proof and the standards that they apply to both the SEC and the NASD more harshly. Because once you shift from a prophylactic, you're prohibited from doing something in the future, to a penalty, the natural consequences before a trier of facts imposes that, they're going to maybe raise the bar, not necessarily clear and convincing against preponderance of evidence, but just the music, if not the words, of these matters. And those two cases, one is the Seventh Circuit, one is the Eleventh Circuit, if you read them, one is Smythe and one is WHX, I believe, both suggest, if you read the cases, that the courts are having trouble in the way that the agency applied the power in a particular case and concluded they weren't going to allow a cease and desist order to be entered in one case. In another case, they said the $200,000 penalty was inappropriate, and the commission later reduced it to $40,000 on remand. And so what I think I'm seeing is the courts reacting in part to this enhanced use of powers. I don't know, Bill or Ralph, if that's your experience and whether that's a trend and whether you see that as a challenge for the agency.
It is a dangerous trend for the SEC. The SEC should not be forced to litigate all of their cases and turn into just another litigant. If they take principal positions, 99% of those cases should be settled, and the courts are getting tired of it. You've got the Smythe and the WHS case, which you've mentioned. There are two other cases that are out there now that are equally difficult, the Scrushy opinion and that FD opinion, where the courts are saying on the Scrushy side, look, you know, you just got too close in bed with the criminal prosecutors, and you didn't let the other side know that you were setting him up for a criminal prosecution. We're not going to let you use the evidence.
Yeah.
In another case, the courts are saying on this Reg FD, you just went way too far, that you said that it was a breach of an FD to do something that a normal human being would never say that to be. And when the courts start saying that, what happens is it erodes the confidence of other courts, I think, in the integrity and the legitimacy of the commission's positions. And it shouldn't happen. And I'll tell you, I am not, because notwithstanding my hyperbole, I'm someone who, as everyone else here, loves this agency. I do not relish when this agency loses a case in court. When it loses a case in court, I know that it's going to make its job, and indeed, over the long run, my job, more difficult. We like to see them win, but we like to see them win where they should win and not where they take these extremes.
Other than your clients.
Yeah, Ted, I think what Ralph said is, in a sense, what I had been saying. The issue here is not should they not be pursuing companies and individuals. The issue is discipline and measure. And until courts step in and try to set the equilibrium in a more balanced degree, I don't think that there is much of a governor in many of these cases, because whatever you hear from the staff, most people in most companies and most business enterprises can't litigate with the SEC.
And it gets
The damage to the franchise and the business. And with individuals these days, with the position that's being articulated about indemnification from criminal authorities, it is the rare individual that has the financial wherewithal to stand up to the government even when they believe they're right.
And entities do, and I think it's, while we often hear that we can't afford to fight, et cetera, teams, squadrons of lawyers come in and fight with us every day. People settle every day, in part because they decide it's in their best interest, and more often than not, it's because we've got the facts, and the facts demonstrate the violation, and we get to the point where we are, in fact, settling virtually, you know, somewhere north of 90% of our matters. And all the I'm not surprised that, you know, there are cases that go against us. The litigated cases are the hardest, but we're winning a lot. And juries understand the facts. Juries are having no difficulty coming to terms with the facts and holding people accountable. So I'm not surprised we're going to lose some, but I think our focus on the facts is a record we can be proud of.
Ted, if I could say one thing, the only greater risk to the system from the defense lawyers drinking their own Kool-Aid is the government drinking its own Kool-Aid, which it has in vats.
Boy, I don't know how we can top that. What I'd like to... we didn't get to another subject, which we don't have time for, which is the whole question of cooperation and the ability to get credit for cooperation both at the NASD and SEC. There's been a lot said on that, the question of whether you have to waive attorney-client privilege as a condition of that, and that whole subject is another aspect of this whole arena in today's environment, which is something that we'll have to leave for another day. I think we just about at the end of our session. What I would like to do is thank Ralph, Bill, Mary, and Linda for a great discussion today. I'd like to remind our audience, both here and those listening online, that the audio tape of this is now in the museum and archive at sechistorical.org, and a transcript of the program will be ready soon. I also was remiss in not mentioning at the beginning that in part this program was made possible through a grant from the Association of SEC Alumni, Inc., ASECA, for which we are very thankful. And on behalf of my fellow trustees, I am chairman of the SEC Historical Society. I would like again to thank Professor Allen and the New York University Center for Law and Business for joining in partnership with us to present the program today. And thank you all.